Change happens. How we respond to change can make or break us and our careers. Join us for an intimate insight into how senior business leaders face change. The good, the bad, and everything in between. Because whether we like it or not, change happens.
Hi, I'm Janelle McMaster, and this is the Change Happens podcast, a conversation with influential leaders on leading through change and the lessons learned along the way. And today I'm joined on the podcast by French Open 2020 winner in wheelchair tennis, Dylan Alcott. Dylan is our first athlete on the podcast, and what an athlete he is. He's won three Paralympic gold medals in two sports, basketball and tennis, was awarded 2016 GQ Sportsman of the Year, 2016 Paralympian of the Year, and 2016 Newcomb Medal. That was a big year. He's Australia's youngest ever wheelchair basketball Olympic gold medalist, and he's also been ranked number one in the world as a quad competitor in wheelchair tennis, with his most recent Grand Slam tennis win taking his tally to 11. Now, as if his sporting achievements weren't enough, Dylan received an Order of Australia in 2009 at the age of 18, and he's the founder of the Dylan Alcott Foundation, which focuses on enriching the lives of young people with disabilities by eliminating the barriers of entry to get involved in sport and study. In 2017, he co-founded the disability and access training startup called Get Skills Access and also began hosting on national radio station Triple J. He's now on Weekend Breakfast with the Hit Network. Dylan is an outstanding motivational speaker, which I'm sure will be apparent in our discussion today. He's a philanthropist, radio compere, DJ. He's rapped on stage with the Wu-Tang Clan and also set a trend for wheelchair crowd surfing at Australia's biggest music festivals. He's an author, because of course he is, of a book called Able. And look, there's so much more that if I went into it, we'd never actually get to hear from the man himself. I will call out, though, that he does have a Logie. Yep, last year he also picked himself up the Graham Kennedy Logie for Most Popular New Talent. So clearly this is an all-round legend of a human being and someone who I'm absolutely pumped to be speaking with today. Dylan, welcome.
G'day, Janelle. That's a fair pump up.
I need to lie down after that.
Imagine if I'm fair, if I'm crap right now. First athlete and I bomb this podcast.
No pressure, but I'm expecting huge things.
I appreciate you having me on today. Thank you.
Thanks for joining. And look, massive congratulations to you on that stellar win in the French Open. I know that you're undergoing the mandatory 2 weeks quarantine. How are you coping? The highs and the not so highs.
Yeah, coping fine. I've got to tell you, it was pretty weird. We look, first and foremost, I felt very lucky to be able to go away during a pandemic and do my job and things like that. And I just want to send my love to everybody listening that's been affected by it, because it's been pretty tough for a lot of people, and especially people's mental health and things like that. And, you know, it was definitely different overseas. There was, you know, COVID is maybe not taken as seriously, say, in some parts of the world compared to what we're doing in Australia. And I've never, safe to say, when I got off the plane, I wasn't expecting my own police escort into a hotel room, whereby you go in and then you literally can't leave for 2 weeks. So I'm doing my hotel quarantine up in Sydney, and yeah, the police and the army and everyone doing it did an incredible job to get us here. But yeah, it's definitely a little bit different.
Yeah, it is different. You can pretend it's because of your rock star status and not because of the need to quarantine.
Well, that was the first time I've ever been back in a divvy van or a paddy wagon. So my girlfriend, we got in the car. She said, "It wasn't the first time I've been in here." I thought, oh, that's right.
Look, it's definitely been a whirlwind couple of months. You've had competing at the US and the French Grand Slams, but I know in June it looked quite unlikely that the wheelchair category in the US Open would take place because of the pandemic. And I know that you were candid in expressing your, let's call it, discontent around that situation. So tell me a bit about what it was like over that period and how did it all play out, pardon the pun.
Yeah, so the US Open decided they were going to go ahead, which I thought was great. I thought we were going to be included, and then the press release came out and there was no mention of wheelchair tennis, and that actually cancelled the wheelchair tennis but not the able-bodied tennis, and they didn't tell us. They just expected it to go under the rug. Now, I was pretty flat with that because, you know, I feel like we as athletes with a disability in the past might have been seen as second-class citizens, and a lot of people with disability all around the world still feel like that. And to be honest, you know, I wasn't angry. I was really sad. Like, to be blatantly discriminated against really hurt. And I just expressed my feelings. Did I think it was going to get 10 million impressions online? Did I think it was going to be on the page 3 of the New York Times? Did I think Andy Murray was going to call me and say, "Hey, Dil, I've spoken to Roger Federer and Rafa and Novak and put in the WhatsApp and we want to help get you back in there. No, I didn't think that would happen. But credit to the US Open, they realised that they made a mistake and changed it so we could compete. But, you know, this happens every day to people with a disability. Able-bodied people decide what restaurants we can go into, what airlines we can fly, what jobs we get the opportunity to apply for, what universities we can go to. That choice is often taken away from us because of people's unconscious biases and a lack of understanding what about, you know, discrimination and things like that. So, yeah, I felt like it was our – I had to stand up for my community, and I'm really glad we got the opportunity to play. I didn't win. I played crap in the final, unfortunately, but got a little bit of revenge in the French Open, which
absolutely you did. And it really speaks to the power of the platform that you have, which clearly you, whether or not you intended for those things to happen, it certainly was a powerful use of your profile and network.
Yeah. Well, I think also one of the things which was always, I think, really tough for people with a disability and the generations before me is there was always, you know, people who could speak up for inequality when it comes to gender bias or the LGBTQI community or racism or whatever it is. But for people with a disability, there was, and there still isn't, enough people in the mainstream with that voice to stand up for our community. So I think, you know, previously when someone got discriminated with a disability, no one cared or knew. So I think now one of the things I'm so thankful for and I'm so privileged to be in a position is that for some reason, unknowns to me, the community and the Australian public and people have really bought into my story, you know what I mean? And they've really got behind me, which gave me that platform to speak out and something that I don't take for granted because, you know, when I get discriminated against on an airline or whatever, they're buying me red wine because they don't want me to call them out because they know that I'm a bit famous, right?
Mm.
But what if you're a 40-year-old lady with MS?
Sure.
Or a little kid with cerebral palsy at school? You know, they don't have the profile that I have, so they get discriminated against. So I think it's important for not only people with profile like me to stand up for the community with people with disability, but also, you know, all of us to continue to highlight people with a disability who are doing great in our community as well because we need more voices out there, not just, you know, myself or other Paralympians or whatever it is.
Yeah. And just on that, you know, the challenges, you know, I know that COVID has, you know, added so many more challenges for people with a disability, you know, simple things like the virus, surviving on the surfaces of wheelchairs or being unable to rely on support workers if they're unwell. There's been the need to isolate more due to compromised health and the risk of contracting COVID. From your perspective and what's been toughest and what are you seeing is particularly tough for people with a disability and how can we continue to create an inclusive environment for them, particularly during this time?
Ripping question. Look, a few things. First and foremost, you know, the pandemic's been terrible for everybody, but I know some people that have been in full isolation have not seen a single person since February because of their compromised health. So I'm not saying all people with a disability have compromised health, but if you are immunocompromised or you have problems with the respiratory system due to your disability, well then, you know, that's a long time ago. And it's probably going to be for a little while longer. So, you know, people go, oh, it's just a mild cold. Why can't we get out and live? Yeah, it might be for you, but it's not for some people. You know what I mean? So I think in particular, the people of Australia have played such an incredible role to do the right thing, to make sure there's limited numbers all around the country, especially people from Melbourne at the moment, which is where I'm from. You know, they've done it tougher than anybody throughout the country. Mm-hmm. As you said, some support workers decided not to work anymore because they didn't want to get infected or infect other people, you know what I mean? So if you need full-time support, it's often been harder to get. But there are, you know, incredible support network companies out there. Like, you know, I do a bit of work for one called Mabel, whereby they've made sure that they've done everything in their power to not only get in the home and help people when they need it, but also support work through online systems to benefit people, you know, with their mental health and connect and things like that. Because I think one thing I hated, Janelle, about the pandemic is the word social distancing. Right. Because people distanced physically, but they also distanced socially. Mm. They didn't check in on people. They didn't say hi. They didn't make sure they're okay. I think the term physical distancing is way better because you still socially check in on people. But for people with a disability that have been in isolation for a long time, they've found that they haven't had that social connection,
which then isolating. In turn, you know,
it is. It affects their mental health as well. One of the other biggest things as well that I'm really passionate about but also worried about is obviously the economy has been hit so hard and people's employment have been affected massively, whether you're disabled or not. But something that I'm really passionate about is trying to advocate for people with a disability to get employment. For example, there are, you ready for this? There
I'm
are
ready.
4.6 million people in Australia with some kind of physical or non-physical disability. One in five Australians have a disability.
Wow.
Did you know that? That's a massive number.
Didn't realise it was as high as that.
Yeah, and for that, of that 4.6 million, only 50% of those people can find a job, which is devastating, yeah, even though they want to. So one thing I'm super worried about is corporate Australia, you know, they were starting to look towards people with a disability to start working within their workforces, but obviously with the pandemic, people's bottom lines and things have been affected massively. So I hope those opportunities are still there for people with disability to get out and work, especially on the back end of what's going on. And I think it's all of us in corporate Australia to continue to provide those opportunities because
I think you're right.
People with a disability make incredible, you know, can make a huge impact on the workforce.
Well, I know that you are certainly doing plenty in that space yourself. I believe you're in the process of launching a new business, Able Foods, which works in some part to creating employment opportunities as well, get skilled access, same deal. Do you want to tell me a bit about those and how they help that particular cause?
Yeah, so I've founded two organisations. One of them, they're both profit for purposes. One's called Get Skilled Access. So we're a consulting company working with governments and corporates to help them better understand the needs of people with disabilities. So not only get them ready to employ people with a disability, but also get them ready to improve their customer service and product offerings so people with a disability can be their consumers as well. People are often shocked to know, as I said, about the high numbers of people with a disability within the country. But people with a disability also have studies show they have higher productivity than able-bodied people when they get a job. Mm-hmm. They have lower absenteeism and they have higher retention rates as well. But as I said, unemployment is well over double compared to able-bodied people, and only 50-odd% can find employment. So it's about educating corporate Australia and governments about what people with a disability can really do, but also how easy it is for them to integrate people with a disability within their workforce. Because often, you know, people overcomplicate the process and think it's too hard, or they think people with a disability can't do it, or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And all of our consultants have a disability as well, all lived experience, which is cool. Mm-hmm. And yeah, the other organisation I'm about to launch is called Able Foods. I often talk to businesses about how to employ people with a disability and the benefits. And I thought, you know what, stuff this, I'm just going to go do it. One thing that I really struggled with that was tough for me was getting around the house and creating food and looking after my diet and things like that, because mm-hmm. obviously it's quite hard to cook, you know, like yep. benches are too high, you might drop things on yourself, things like that. So we started a ready-made meal service to help people with a disability live happier and healthier lives, providing them with a nutritious meal plans and things like that. And with the NDIS, which has been, you know, a huge benefit to people with a disability across the country, people on the NDIS can get our services for a very, very minimal cost, which is pretty cool as well. And throughout the whole business, whether it's in the office, whether it's creating the food, whether it's in the warehouse, we only employ people with a disability. So trying to provide those opportunities as well.
I love that. It's the product helps people with a disability and the creation of the product helps people with a disability. So it's got a great sort of circular reinforcement in the model.
Yeah, that's the plan. And hopefully we can show other businesses, you know, just what assets people with a disability can be. And it's my, you know, I love winning Grand Slam tennis tournaments, but my true passion in life is trying to help people with a disability get out and live the lives that they deserve to live. That's why I get out of bed every day. And luckily the Grand Slams, and that gives me the profile and the platform to be able to do that, which is pretty cool. And yeah, that's why these entities, I'm just trying to further that as much as I can.
Well, let's just talk about the Grand Slams for a minute, just in the sense that, you know, clearly sport has been an amazing platform for you to be able to do these other passion areas as well that you've talked about now. You've been quoted as saying, "Sport saved my life." Pretty profound statement. How did it save your life?
Oh, yeah, it 100% did. I mean, people know me, might know me as the person they see on telly, and I'm a I like to think that the person they might see on telly is exactly the same as I am, because I try and be as authentic and all the time, and I'm always me. I can't honestly be anybody that I'm not. But when I was 12, 13, 14, I hated my disability. I got bullied about my disability, and I was pretending to be someone that I wasn't, and my life was sucked. It really did. And I never thought I was going to get over it. I never thought I was going to be anybody. And I didn't think I'd even be sitting here potentially talking to you today. And I mean that. And that was until I started playing sport. And you can take away all the gold medals and grand slams. I tell you, the biggest thing that sport did for me, it introduced me to people that were like me. Wow. I'd never really met anybody, people with a disability, but I started playing sport and I was like, oh my God, that guy in a wheelchair is driving a car. Mm. Oh my God, that lady in a wheelchair is married. She's got kids. Oh my God, that person's got a uni degree. I didn't know you could do any of those things. You know what I mean? So it's that social aspect of sport was massive for me. And it just so happened that I was all right at it. You know what I mean? And I'm so glad that it gave me so many opportunities to travel the world, to do something that I'm passionate about. But I think something that's been a big passion for me is not only trying to change the way people view people with a disability in our community, but also the way people view athletes with a disability in our sporting field as well. Because, I get it. We have inspirational stories and everyone always goes, oh my God, they're so inspirational. They're so inspirational. And there might be that element to it, but I tell you what else we are: elite athletes who train our backside off and put on a show every single time that we play. And something that I'm really proud about is the way that corporate Australia, broadcasters and ticket holders alike now are starting to care about Paralympic sport.
It must have been something else when I know that you were on Centre Court recorded live in one of your Grand Slams. That must have been quite a moment of, this is now not playing second fiddle. It is a main event in itself. That must have been incredible. Yeah.
It was one of the, most amazing experiences of my life, especially, if you did go back 5 years when I started playing tennis again, my first Australian Open, there was probably six people watching me and I knew three of them. Like to have 10,000 people at Rod Laver Arena, a million people watch it on TV, and it's changing the landscape of Paralympic sport. And I don't take for granted that I'm the lucky one. I'm the one with sponsors and things like that. The generation before me, it was so hard for them because they didn't have that opportunity to get sponsors, broadcasters, people didn't buy tickets to watch, yet they were still putting the same amount of effort and winning the same tennis tournaments and things like that as I was. So I just want to leave the next, the sport, Paralympic sport, in a better spot for the next generation of young athletes to come. They deserve it just as much as their able-bodied counterparts.
Now, you've been quoted as saying, if I could take a magic pill, that would mean I'm not in a wheelchair anymore. You couldn't pay me enough to take it. I've thought about that sentence a bit, and to me, at least, and you can tell me your take on it, but to me it felt like you see your disability as a superpower rather than a liability. And it's something that I'm really interested in. One of my previous guests, I think Wendy Harmer, interviewed a couple of weeks ago, and she talked about that moment when she recognised that her differences were actually her strengths. I'm just wondering whether or not, that's the way you meant it when you said that, and whether there was a particular moment or an event or something that happened which made you realise that, or whether it's just something in hindsight you've come to appreciate it.
I think my disability is my biggest asset in my life, or one of my biggest assets. It doesn't define me, but it plays a massive role in who I am. And I used to shy away from that. I used to not be proud of my disability. I used to get called a cripple and a spastic at school. And I believe
them. It's so jarring to hear that.
Yeah, and I believe them. And I sat at home for 2 years of my life thinking, why me? Why am I disabled? And then I looked in the mirror one day and I thought, stuff this, I've got to try and get my life back. And I found that people didn't actually hate me because of my disability. They were just actually awkward and didn't understand it and didn't want to talk about it and used to shy away from it. And I found as soon as I started talking about my disability and embracing it and being proud of it, everybody else around me became more comfortable about it too. And the most important thing that I can pass on is the importance of a positive perception of your situation, because it's not the events in life that dictates the life that you live. It's how you perceive those events that determines the path that you take. And you know what, I'm not trying to say I'm always positive about my situation of having a disability. For example, I want to have a kid one day and I'm going to have to ask my brother, Zach, to teach him how to kick a football because I can't do it.
Mm.
That sucks. When it's summertime, I have to watch people like yourself, Janelle, run along the sand and jump in the water at the beach, something I've never been able to do, nor will I. And that sucks as well. But for every one thing that I can't do, there are 10,000 other things that I can do. And I'm easily the luckiest guy in Australia, if not this world, to be living the life that I live. And I get sent so much stuff about stem cell research and things like that and go, why don't you try this? And I can honestly say there's not enough money in the whole world you could ever pay me enough to do it, because I used to say the Dylan in the wheelchair and the Dylan that walks is the same Dylan, but that's not true, because the Dylan in a wheelchair is a much better version of any other Dylan that could have ever lived. And I honestly would not change my situation for anything. And if I was able-bodied, would have I won 11 Grand Slams? Would I be gold medalist? Would I met my beautiful partner, Chantel, who I love so much? Probably not. So why would I give all that up?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like I'm so lucky to be who I am, for sure. When I can't get up a few stairs and someone tells me I can't go in their venue, that's bullshit and that annoys me. But, hey, there's so many other things that I can do. So I try not to get too caught up in those things.
That's incredibly powerful. And, you know, I think there's some really important lessons there in terms of the way you perceive the events. You instituted, obviously, the Dylan Allcott Foundation, which was about helping young Australians who are struggling to come to terms with their disability to help them fulfil their potential, achieve their dreams. Just sort of how do you go about convincing and helping them to shift their mindsets about possibilities, about ambition? Are you working to change their perceptions of events the way you've just talked about? Are there other mechanisms that you go through to help people change their mindsets about their circumstances?
Yeah, one of the biggest ways to help people change their circumstances is to provide opportunities that they don't normally get. So I think what we do at the Dylan Allcott Foundation is to try and eliminate those barriers to young people with a disability to achieve their dreams. You know, like when I was growing up, you know, I luckily went to a great school and was given opportunities and that, but, you know, you go to speak to people who are career counsellors or going into university and they kind of look at the person with a disability and they're like, oh, well, the kid goes, what can I do? And they're kind of like, I've got no idea. You know what I mean? Or they might not have access to a certain opportunity that they might have. So what I say to them is, as a young person with a disability, for example, when I started to want to play sport, my brother got a $100 pair of footy boots. I needed a $10,000 wheelchair just to even try. And if you can't afford that, well, guess what? You can't do it. You know what I mean? So I think what we're trying to do is provide those opportunities for those youngsters to do what they do. Some of the cool stuff we've already put, a young girl with a disability through university to become an access consultant to make her community more accessible for people with a disability, which is super cool. We've started we've actually given people money to do their own startups because they weren't able to get a job. So instead of actually trying to get a job, we've given them the opportunities to start their own business themselves, which is super cool. Provided sporting equipment so they can go on their quest to become a Paralympian like I have. But it's also that element of, as you said, mentoring and just talking to them about their situation and trying to, I guess, give them a bit of the wisdom that I was able to earn throughout my life about that it's okay to be different. And as soon as you harness that difference and be proud of that, it's actually a more positive thing. But it's really hard to do it's really hard for these kids because, you know, one of the things that I see quite a bit, which, you know, breaks my heart, is I'll meet a young kid with a disability, right? They'll be 12 years old and I'll say, hello, what's your name? And they'll say, hi, my name's Sarah. And I'll say, what's your disability, Sarah? And their parents go, they don't have a disability when they're clearly in a wheelchair.
Trying to normalise it as much as...
Well, because society tells that mother that having a disability is a bad thing. So she tells her kid that they don't have a disability. When I say to them, well, you clearly have a disability and there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. You know what I mean? But societal pressures has told that family that if you have a disability, you can't get a job, you can't go on a date, you are lesser than, you can't do anything. So they tell their kid they don't have a disability when their kid clearly knows they do. So that makes it so hard for them, you know what I mean? So I think it's really important for all of us to try and break that stigma that having a disability is a negative thing. Mm. And that'll give people with a disability the confidence to go out there and be proud of who they are. That only happens when we have that societal shift, when people with a disability are given the opportunities they deserve. And, you know, it's not all doom and gloom because I think it is happening. It is getting better. Mm. But it's up to, you know, people to promote these conversations and talk about it so it can happen quicker.
You've met people and worked with people and played alongside people who've been born with a disability, and you've met people who've had accidents like that, right, later in life. Do you think it's different in dealing with the change and dealing with circumstances? You know, is it a mindset, and is it a propensity to the way you look at the world, or is it situational? You know, this circumstance happened later. I've known a different life, therefore it's harder. Like, what's your views on that?
Yep. It's apples and oranges in some ways, but it's also similar to another. So, yeah, I was born with my disability. I was born with a tumour wrapped around my spinal cord. So I've been in a wheelchair my whole life compared to some of my teammates who were, you know, 20 years old, had a car accident, and the next minute they can't walk. And I can't compare because I obviously didn't have an accident. But one thing I can say is this. When you are 20 years old and you have an accident or whatever, you know what it's like to kick a football. You know what it's like to feel the sand between your toes. But when you have that accident, you lose it. Mm-hmm. So it's an interesting question. Would you rather know what it's like to have and then lose it, or never know, like me? And one thing I will say is when you have an accident, hopefully, or something happens to you, hopefully you have a great support network around you. You might have a partner, friends, family. You know, you've already experienced things in life where you went to school, you might have had a job, you might have went to uni, whatever it is. One thing I can say about being born with a disability, unfortunately, kids can be brutal. Mm-hmm. And it's so hard sometimes for young people with disabilities to get friends, to get opportunities. They get bullied because they're different. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So one maybe good thing about having an accident later in life is that you might have a better support network around you, but there's challenges in both. Mm-hmm. And there's obviously opportunities in both. So it just completely depends about the lens in which you look at it. One of the hardest places to go in the world is a rehabilitation center after an accident, because there are just so many people in there that have had accidents. They've lost legs, they've had brain injuries, they're in wheelchairs, whatever it is, and they think their life's over because that's what they've been told. So that's why changing that narrative is so important, because, yeah, your life is now different, but it's not over. Mm. There are still so many things you can do, and it's up to all of us, especially corporate Australia, to keep providing those opportunities so people realise that their actually life isn't over when something pretty severe happens.
I'm interested in the pace of change when it comes to the disability sector. Not that you're an old man now, of course, but thinking back
I am. I'm getting old. You know, I'm...
No, I can't say that because I'm older than you. So if you're old,
I'm 30 years old. I'm 30 years old in a few weeks. I'm washed up.
Good grief.
Stick a fork.
If only you could do something worthwhile with your life. Well, thinking back to your younger years and the kinds of challenges as a kid you've had with a disability, you know, we've talked about a few of those. Do you think, looking at this situation now, that any of those challenges have lessened? Has societal understanding, for instance, changed? Has technology advancements helped things along? Tell me about the pace of change in the sector.
Change has been so important for people with a disability in the whole sector, and like, you know, I'm so glad I'm born now, put it that way. Looking at photos 30 years ago of the wheelchairs, the way people tried to drive cars, I can't even begin to describe what it's like. Like, my current tennis wheelchair is a carbon fibre mould of my body, the same way Daniel Ricciardo has a carbon fibre mould of his body. And I'm lucky that I'm looked after by a company called Melrose Wheelchairs who do my chairs. But, you know, my chair is worth like $40,000-$50,000. Like, you know, the technology is incredible. Even for people not just with my disability, for people with non-physical disabilities, intellectual disabilities, whatever it is. I got on a plane last year with a guy who was blind, 100% blind. The plane landed. He was with his guide dog. He ordered an Uber Eats on his phone that he can't see or use. Wow. And I was like, how awesome is that? You know what I mean? He was able to get a ride share and get food or whatever it is using technology through his watch and through his phone. Now, that helps him be independent and things like that, which is super awesome to see. The one thing that is changing but needs to change quicker is societal perceptions, stigmas, and opportunities. Mm-hmm. I like to think that employment of people with a disability is getting better, yet the unemployment rate is exactly the same as 10 years ago.
Yep.
The population of people with a disability is 4.6 million people, yet only 3 to 4% of them are actually in the workforce throughout corporate Australia, in Australia's biggest organisations. The public sector in some states, only 2% of their staff have a disability.
Why is it that you think society has been so slow to move on this?
Yeah, there's a number of reasons. There is a perception that people with a disability can't do the job as well as able-bodied people. There is a perception that it's going to be expensive or hard to onboard people with a disability. One of the things I say is, if you compare you and I, right, the only if you have to do a workplace adjustment for me and you to work at the same place, I actually save money because I BYO chair. I bring my own chair to the desk, right? So we get rid of your chair, and then we're actually it's actually saving resources. But actually, people often think that it's a hard process when actually it's not. And when you do require workplace adjustment, there's government funding to do it, so it actually costs you no money. I think also there's just a lack of education around it, right? I often hear is, oh, we once employed someone with a disability, right? We put them in a teamwork of 10. No one really talked to him. And then, he actually ended up leaving 6 months later. And I said, did you do any onboard training for those people about how to integrate someone with a disability into your workforce? And they're like, oh, no, we didn't. We didn't think we needed to, right? And I don't blame people that they don't understand the best way to integrate and talk to someone with a disability, because they might have never met someone with a disability. They might have never had any exposure to someone with a disability. And you can't just assume everybody will go, oh, yeah, they'll go up and talk to them, even though they're in an electric wheelchair and have a speech impediment or whatever it is. You know what I mean? So you can't assume that. So it's so great that there are now education tools like what we've done at Get Skilled Access to educate people out there about the best way to integrate and onboard people with a disability. But also, we need more government funding. We need more people to realise that this is a great thing to do. And I'm not complaining, because it is getting better. It is happening. Change, there is a thirst for it. There definitely is. The example that I give is 15 years ago, if you were homophobic in your workplace, right, you might have got away with it potentially, right? And these days, you aren't allowed to do that.
That's right.
And rightfully so. You get destroyed. You will lose your job. Your business will go under. You know, you will lose customers. Now, if you are discriminatory to people with a disability, hopefully not, but maybe you might get away with it. You know, it might not be as big. But guess what? I want to look back in 5 years. I want it to be now. And we look back and say, you cannot do that, because disability is now in the mainstream, just like the LGBTQI community, just like gender equality, just like race, just like religion. You know what I mean? People always say, when they talk about diversity, they always say the other four or five streams, and they seem to never mention disability until now. It's starting to become in that conversation, which is awesome. So I think change is starting to happen. And I think it's up to all of us to keep promoting it.
Good on you. Clearly, man, you're a powerhouse of motivation, inspiration here. When was that moment that you're like, you know what, I have to exercise my voice. I've got the ability to use my voice here. Was there a particular moment when you went, yeah, I'm going to put myself out there?
You kind of fall into it a bit. One thing I will say is I never made a point of doing it. I made a point of being me. So being authentic to me, not trying to be, being fully proud of my disability, talking about it, taking the piss out of it, making jokes out of myself. I'm not going to not talk about it. Like, it's the elephant in the room.
At the risk of being ironic, you've just made it so accessible.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and I didn't do it on purpose. I honestly didn't do it on purpose, right? I was just like, I'm going to give everybody the 100% full view of it. Like, I'm going to talk about sex and disability. I'm going to talk about what it was like going on a date. Like, I'm going to talk about how upset it makes me feel when I get discriminated. I'm not going to not, because it's true. And everyone was like, you know, maybe there was a thirst for it, but it had cut through. And that gave me the platform to be able to talk about these things I'm most passionate about. And I mean this, I could win 25 Grand Slams, 10 gold medals, hopefully, whatever it is, and I would regret not doing what I was put here to do, which is try and help people with a disability get out there and live the lives that they deserve to live. I know I said that before, but it honestly, it's my passion in life. And I think the key to unlocking success in your own personal life, within your work life, is happiness and purpose, right? They're the two things, right? It's not money. It's not cars. It's not, you know, in my case, tournaments, championships, whatever. It's not. And that goes across all of us. It's happiness and purpose. I love my life. One of the reasons I'm so happy is because I have that purpose. You know what I mean? And it also helps me perform at my best. I'm so lucky to be who I am. I really am. And I don't take that for granted. And I want people like me to feel the same way that I do.
Mm.
Because unfortunately, they don't. Because they haven't had the opportunities that I've had. They've never been on a date. They've never been in love.
Mm.
They've never had a job. They've never been to a restaurant. Like, and that's serious. They've never done those things because they haven't been given the opportunities or felt like they can. That's, you know, why I do what I do. And if it helps even one person, well, then that's awesome. You know what I mean? And
I do.
I'm not going to stop being me. And people might see me in the media and go, oh, that guy's a dickhead and I don't like him or whatever. And you can do that. I couldn't care less because I'm just being me. I'm not trying to be anybody else. I'm not trying to please anyone. I'm just trying to, you know, help in any small way that I can.
Well, personal plea for me, please don't ever stop being you because we need you. You know, you said that you kind of fall into these things, these opportunities, but there's got to be some sort of fear of the unknown when you're presented with new opportunities. Wondering, like, whether it's, you know, radio, DJ, or, do you kind of go in with a, hell yeah, I'm in, or is it, oh, I'll give it a crack, and then you become bolder over time as you kind of get success with that? How do you approach new opportunities?
I'm just like you and anyone else. I'm thinking, how the F am I going to do this? And I've got no idea what I'm doing.
I'm going to nail it. That's the difference. Oh, no, I don't.
Yeah. I remember the second I got offered this job on Triple J, I had one lesson of how to – by the way, on radio, everyone thinks everyone runs the panel. When I was on Triple J, I did everything. You do all the buttons. You do everything. Mm. It's like a spaceship, right? I had one lesson and then I was broadcasting live to the whole of Australia. Mm-hmm. I had no idea what I was doing, but I'm always thinking, hey, I'll figure it out. You know what I mean?
Yep.
And I don't know. Maybe I shy away from this. I don't write on the wall, I'm going to get a job as a broadcaster. I'm going to interview Prince Harry. I'm going to win this. I'm not that kind of guy.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe they're in the back of my head. But for some reason, all these opportunities keep coming, right? But I will say this. People say, you know, you might be lucky, and I'm very lucky to be in my position, but you 100% make your own luck
mm-hmm.
in the sense that you put yourself in situations where these opportunities will come.
Mm-hmm.
If I was still that fat kid that I was, eating Doritos, playing video games at home, I would never have had all these opportunities because they're not going to just fall in my lap at home, are they? Mm-hmm. You have to put yourself out there. You have to buy a ticket to win the raffle. And if you put yourself out there, good things tend to happen. So I just realized that I've got to keep putting myself out there in situations that I might feel uncomfortable, but that's where things seem to happen. So I will always have a crack. We did the non-for-profit, the DAF, the Dylan Ocko Foundation, or whether it's Able Foods or GSA or whatever it is. I had no idea what I was doing when I founded these things, but I just found a way to do it. And as a result, you know, you not only have success, but you also realize it's okay to ask for help.
Mm-hmm.
It's okay to ask questions. It's okay to put yourself out there to other people and say, can you help me with this? And the one thing I have found is 99.99% of people will help you. You know, if you're a good person and you're doing a good thing, people seem to get behind you.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really lucky that it's not a me, it's a we. Like, we have done this, whether it's the people that are in our team, whether it's the public, you know, we've all got behind this crazy journey and message that I constitute in my head, and I actually can't believe that it's actually come true.
Love that. You've certainly had the opportunity to meet some pretty amazing people along your journey. I know there's been world leaders in there, royalty, actors, musicians. Who stood out to you in terms of leadership or inspiration? Who's kind of made that mark on you?
The people that have had the biggest influence on my life personally would be my brother and my family.
Mm-hmm.
I know my brother Zach is my best mate in the whole world. But when we were kids, he used to want to watch what he wanted on TV. So he used to put the Foxtel remote on top of the fridge where I couldn't reach it. Right? What a jerk. But retrospectively, best thing he ever did, because he never cared I was in a wheelchair. He treated me like I was like any other brother. And he always protected me so much, you know what I mean, mm-hmm. from bullies and things like that. So he was massive. And my parents, they never wrapped me in cotton wool because I was different, which made a big impact. In terms of my sporting career, probably one of the biggest influences was a guy called Pat Rafter.
Pretty familiar with that name.
Yeah, not that I had much to do with him originally, but I used to watch him on TV, win, lose, draw, whatever. He was just always a great bloke.
Mm.
And he was always gracious in victory or defeat. I wanted to be like that as well. He also looks great in underwear. I think I would look great in underwear, you know. So I'm still waiting for a underwear brand to come knocking. They haven't come knocking.
Okay, there's still time. There's still time.
Time. And it's pretty cool now when I win something and Pat shoots me a text or we had a hit at the Australian Open, whatever it is. It was pretty cool getting to interview Prince Harry. Mm. He doesn't do interviews. He does conversations, right? So he doesn't do interviews. It's not an interview deal. It's conversations. All right, fair enough. And we had all the royal protocol and things like that. And to be able to have a conversation, as they said, with him was pretty incredible. And one thing I loved what he's done for people with a disability through his work with the Invictus Games and things like that. Yep. But I remember thinking to myself, all right, you've interviewed rock stars, musicians, politicians, everyone. And I've always think, if you take away all that, do you know what they are? They're just people.
People.
Mm-hmm. Right? And I thought, you know what, I'm just going to be myself. And I thought, that's brave. You know, there's all this royal protocol. We had this chat with Prince Harry. I made him put on a pair of budgie smugglers. He said, yes, believe it. Went viral. And then you're not allowed to touch royalty. I was on a roll. I forgot. I patted him on the back. Idiot. He patted me back on the back. And I was like, we gave each other a hug. Like I couldn't, and it went so well.
Wow.
And then his press secretary came up after and said, oh, that was one of the best interviews he's done. And I said, oh, I thought it was a conversation. Hey, very good. And he just made me realize, like, he's one of the most high profile, in demand people in the world. And I would hate, his life would be so tough. Like the amount of press they get.
Particularly now.
But if you strip all that away, he was just a normal dude.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I think we all were like that. And it was a good lesson for me just to always be authentic to you. You know what I mean? Because everybody, the people that are in these successful positions or whatever it is, are just that, you know what I mean? For the most part, they're just being them. And that makes you vulnerable to being open. But if you are open, whether you're a CEO, you know, I talk to a lot of people in the C-suite level, and some people feel like they can't be the vulnerable selves because they have to be this position of power.
Mm.
You know what I mean? But your staff relates to you.
Absolutely.
When you are vulnerable. And that's powerful. And I think that's an important lesson that I learn and try and pass on to a lot of people.
Yeah, and I do think that there's been a growing recognition and realisation of that, particularly during COVID when everyone's kind of been in the same boat together. We're all sort of stuck in our room. People are seeing, you know, dirty laundry in the backgrounds of CEOs. And it's been so fantastic for people to see that vulnerability in the human side.
I love doing a Zoom call. And you try and guess where everybody is.
Yeah.
Like you're like, you're in bed, aren't you? Because my kids are screaming.
That's fantastic. I have to ask you, tell me, you know, I said in the intro that you were crowd surfing in a wheelchair, in a mosh pit of sorts, right? And which I can't get my head around that even in a COVID world now. But what was that like?
Yeah, well, I was just sick and tired of looking at people's asses all day, you know? So you can't see much down there. And then I obviously got picked up. First time was at Coachella during his Jay-Z gig, and he like stopped the set and said, yo, give it up for this dude. And I called the best seat in the house because obviously like they pick up the wheelchair. It's the only time I get to see. And I don't like sitting out the back. My friends always go, we'll sit out the back with you. I go, no, stuff that. Mm. We'll go in. So you can have fun. And guess what? I've only been dropped once. And okay. I didn't end up.
That's probably once too many, isn't it?
Well, I only got dropped once and I didn't end up any more disabled than I started. So don't worry about that. That's what I assured my mum.
So we'll call that a win.
Correct.
The last three fast questions on change to finish the podcast.
All right, Dylan, I'm going to wrap up with a fast three questions for you. What's a misconception that most people have about you?
The biggest misconception, if you actually don't know who I am, is that I can't do anything. For example, not too long ago, I ordered a coffee and this lovely lady came up to me and she was in tears and she congratulated me on ordering my coffee.
Oh, myself. My gosh.
I said to her, well, it's great to see you getting your own coffee too. And now, but her misconception is that I can't do anything.
Mm-hmm.
And the biggest barrier in my life is not ramps, not stairs, not access. It's a lack of expectation of what people think.
Yeah, it's underestimating you. Okay, what's one guilty pleasure?
My guilty pleasure is I absolutely love sitting on the couch and doing nothing. Oh, when I get the opportunity, I can relax like with the best of them. When I do get the opportunity to do nothing, I'm extremely good at it.
I'm going to feel like I know what you're going to answer this question with, but what's one thing you're hopeless at?
Besides walking?
Yeah, I thought you were going to go for walking.
Yeah. I tell you what I can't do. I cannot draw even a single stick man.
Oh.
I like to say I have two disabilities, walking and drawing. I have no artistic ability. I mean, maybe I do have artistic ability in like broadcasting and that,
mm-hmm.
but when it comes to arts and crafts, absolutely, I'm shocking, absolutely shocking at it.
Okay, well, there we have it. Dylan, I want to thank you for your time today. I've enjoyed every single moment of it. So much for people to take away. For me, there's been a bunch of things. One, clearly, you've taken a lesson out of Pat Rafter's book. You are a great bloke and you're smack of authenticity. And I want to thank you for making disability accessible, approachable, giving people a language to kind of just ask the questions that they wanted to do, make that fine to learn. I think you've raised consciousness about how prolific disability is in Australia. One in five is pretty profound. I love that you've talked about the power of harnessing difference, the power of reframing how you perceive events, the need for us to change the narrative. And I love the, the whole stuff this, I'm just going to go and do it. Stuff this, I'm going to, take my life back. I think, you've managed to make those two words sound pretty profound. Thank you so much, Dylan. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Hey, you're an absolute legend. Thank you for having me on. And if anyone wants to get in touch, please hit me up on my social media. It's just my name, @DylanAlcott, or want to do any work with any of the companies that I have, please reach out, because I'd love to help, love to get involved. And I've got to say, you're a bloody good broadcaster. You and I could do radio together, too.
I'm up for it.
We could do some AM talk back. Let me just retire and that could be our new gig.
Okay, well, let's take that one offline. Like it. Thanks, Dylan. We'll put the links to your pages as well on our post.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
The Change Happens podcast from EY, a conversation on leading through change. Discover more where you get your podcasts.